So we spoke last week a little bit about Cheshbon HaNefesh. We spoke last week in terms of the Rambam, the Chovos HaLevavos, and Ramchal, what the emphasis is and what are the questions that I'm asking. Am I balanced? Am I in the middle of the Shvil HaZahav of the Rambam? Am I asking for the Chovos HaLevavos? Have I repaid the debt, the gratitude I'm supposed to have to Ribono Shel Olam? Have I acted appropriately and able to give back to Ribono Shel Olam that which I should be giving back? Spoke about whether it's really an interesting Ha'ar of Rav Shigar, that for the Ramchal, it's the beginning. It's a prerequisite for us to be able to be successful Jews. We spoke about Chovos HaLevavos, it's more of a higher level. It's really a question as to what kind of person you really are. You're a self-reflect, growth-oriented kind of person, or not, and to try to figure out, it's more of something to aspire to be a person that engages in Cheshbon HaNefesh. It's not the prerequisite, but ultimately what we're trying to really build for. I want to speak about how we engage in Cheshbon HaNefesh, and to highlight, I think, two or three different approaches. We'll speak a little bit in the beginning about the Bali Musar. We'll hopefully have time to speak about Rav Kook. Then we can share insights from an interesting article about those who are engaged in professions and working and a variety of perspectives that can be relevant as far as the role of Cheshbon HaNefesh when you are a person that's working and has a lot on your plate, how to manage that. So we're going to try to speak about a bunch of different things. But let's begin as follows. If you're talking about Cheshbon HaNefesh, you're talking about being the kind of person that reflects on and is focused on a certain kind of ruchnius, a certain kind of like holding yourself to certain standards. So undoubtedly the Bali Musar come to mind. One of the defining components of the Musar movement is that a person's supposed to be reflecting on their actions, a certain kind of self-appraisal, to make sure like where are you really at in a very, very intense way. We're going to speak about two or three elements of Bali Musar. We're going to speak about some differences as far as how Bali Musar reflect on Cheshbon HaNefesh. But Rabbi Shaul Salanter was actually very much involved in printing or reprinting the Sefer Cheshbon HaNefesh, obviously relevant to this topic at hand. And it's a defining, again, element of Bali Musar. The Altar of Sabatka in one of his Sichos, source number 2 on the sheet, Sichos HaSabmi Sabatka, page 818. So there he points out, and here's a little bit of Musar, that you know Bilam is the one that we sometimes hold up as a model of a person that made some significant errors. And Bilam is not the kind of Baal Avoda that we are at all searching to be, obviously. Bilam, who was Yodea Das Elyon, the Gemara says, Bilam, who was a person that knew so much and had such tremendous insight, that Bilam is a person, on the one hand, has this enormous potential. Lo kam bi Yisrael kimosha, but bi umas ha'olam, there's a Bilam. Yet Bilam also is a person that's a spiritual failure from a certain perspective. Points out the author of Sabarka, when you look at Bilam's just reaction to the fact that his donkey is speaking, so what you encounter is a person that was able to be in an environment and be in an experience where it should have really jarred him in a very intense kind of a way. That what Bilam should have encountered was a certain kind of experience that, like, my donkey's talking. That's not a standard thing at all to experience. And yet, Bilam is not really impacted by that so much. The author goes on to explain there what he is impacted by. When the donkey starts speaking, it has a certain kind of impact. But in a certain sense, what you're experiencing, what you're perceiving, what you're seeing, is a person that could go through an experience which is, in many ways, very jarring, an experience which can really sort of strike him. And Bilam sits there, and he's witnessing his donkey speaking, and he's, like, not so impacted by it at all. He's just there. And for the altar of Sabatka, what that really sort of indicates is the fact that you can be a person that experiences things in life, and you can be a person that is in an environment where things can potentially move you, but a Bilam can sit there, and he can witness the miracle of a donkey speaking, and not be that responsive at all. Okay, whatever. It is what it is. And that's not what we're searching for. Rav Sabatka, there's a certain kind of Cheshbon HaNefesh, a certain kind of self-appraisal that becomes really important. How did Bali HaMusar engage in Cheshbon HaNefesh? What does it really look like? So it's certainly very often, it's very frequent, but you find something interesting. It's a set of Sfarim called Tnuos HaMusar. Tnuos HaMusar, it's about 4 or 5 volumes where Rav Dov Katz went through the history of the Musar movement. He describes what Rabbi Yisrael did to Salanter in beginning a Musar movement. Like, what was it going to look like? And how do you engage in a certain kind of, like, self-appraisal? So what does that look like? So he says by Bali Musar something interesting. Their Musar Seder was divided up. There were two kinds of Musar Sedarim. We only have one. Okay. But there are two kinds. One would be to learn a Musar Sefer. That's like, I think, what is done most commonly. You have like a Sefer that you're learning through. He thought it was important to be familiar with Sfarim, like Chobos HaLevavot, with like Masilas Yesharim, like Shari Tshuva, Rabbeinu Yonah. There are classics that a person has to be familiar with. There are some that are new. We spoke about Reish Yitzchak. There are different Sfarim that are out. There are different kinds of Musar Sfarim. You have to be familiar with Musar Sfarim. Then he was into, and this is what's very intense, he was into learning not a Musar Sefer per se, but choosing a particular line or a particular section and learning that bihispalus. Learning that like just super intensely, like yelling over and over again, getting out loud. Like this, I don't think I've ever seen. I've certainly never done it, at least in a very intense way. But that's a different half of what Musar looks like. One of the things that Rabbi Yisrael thought as far as the kind of Musar to learn, which ties into a Cheshbon HaNefesh, is that it has to be done in a bit of a separate location. What he called a base HaMusar. A base HaMusar. The base HaMusar was going to be a place that would be open day and night, where people could go in to be able to learn Musar. It was a place that was like a zone, where, you know, it's like we're very much impacted sometimes by the world of place. If you're in Yerushalayim, you're standing in front of the Kotel, so that's supposed to have a certain kind of like impact on you. Like that's a place which is different than if you're at, you know, I would say MetLife Stadium when it's not a Seim HaShas. Like there's all these like different environments supposed to bring out a different kind of experience. And that's what it does. So a Musar movement, part of the theory was that the regular base medrash is a wonderful place. But for the intense avoda of Musar, gotta have your own sort of location. It's a quieter place, a smaller place, where people can go and learn Musar. They can learn Behispalas. You can go in, and here's what's interesting. You can go in, and it can go in as a group. And as a group, it can be you can hear a powerful Musar Shmuz, and there can be conversations, you can be mechazik each other. That's one experience. And sometimes you go into a Beis HaMusar by yourself. And you go into a Beis HaMusar, and you engage in just what you would call, in a certain sense, Cheshbon HaNefesh, that part of what the Bali Musar did wasn't just the frequency of it, but the location of it became important. Being cognizant of the fact that like the location sets a certain tone. Now, many different, like we would say, groups of from Jews are into location playing a role. He points out here, the Beis HaMusar is not the Chassidus Shtibel. The Shtibel is more of like it's a place of davening, people come together, you make some l'chaims, it's a place which is about, you know, it's a certain kind of culture you're creating, a certain kind of simcha and warmth. Bali Musar is, it's a super, super, like, focused kind of a place when you go into a Beis HaMusar. It's supposed to be, like, very, very focused. It's like if you ever go into certain places where it's clear, like, this place is a place of just, like, intense seriousness. It just, there's something about it that's overwhelming. So that's what, I'm thinking, the one example I'm thinking of right now is when I was at Madrichan Tzvi Kol many years ago, and I was giving a public school chabur, and there's one of the kids who was a public school kid, even though he had no shaykhus to public school at all. I don't know why he was there, who was super into Rav Avadia. Kid from, went to Beth Tefillah, I think one of these in Baltimore. He was not going to, I think it was a non-denominational school, I think it was Beth Tefillah that he was in. Somehow he got really into learning and got really into Rav Avadia. Fascinating. So every day, his goal of the summer was to visit Rav Avadia. I told him parts of the story, to visit Rav Avadia. Okay, I don't know, I was in Madrid. So he called like every day, every number he can get, and he finally set up a meeting for us to go. He came over and he's like, okay, we're going to go to Rav Avadia tonight. I was thinking like, okay, you know, it's what you do. So you went and haven't liked Rav Avadia's farm since high school. So I was like, okay, this is cool. So I'm from Michamarv, and there was a place we would daven in his apartment, had like a small shul there, Michamarv, but that wasn't where we met with him. We met with him in like, not the inner chamber, that was like very intense, but like not in the shul, like you walk inside a little bit. And like, first of all, there's like a million like Sfarim everywhere. It's like a million Sfarim. So you're like a little bit overwhelmed. And it's a place where like, the tone of that room, it was just like focused and intense. Not the same as the Beis HaMusar, as a different avoda going on. But you walk in, you're like, okay, no jokes. Nothing. If he can make a joke, that's fine. You can't. You know, like that doesn't work that way. You know, like whatever he wants, slap me in the face, it's all good. You know, like, but I will not. And it still burns a little bit sometimes. But I will not, stings, I think is the right word. But that's that. Certain places that set a certain tone. There is a shift, though, in Bali HaMusar that the Rav describes in Halachic Man, which is a really interesting one. when the Musar movement starts, they start going around and they start trying to convince people to set up similar things to this. And they go to Volozh, and their client Brisker is not so into it at all. It's not his scene. He has a variety of fairly harsh formulations. Musar is really good for people that are sick. Baruch Hashem, here in Volozh, and we're healthy. It's okay. It's okay. So the world, more or less nowadays, has embraces the value of the Musar movement. Soloveitchik thinks there was a shift that's really important. He says the early Baalei HaMusar, and some of us can appreciate this a little bit, the early Baalei HaMusar, what they had when they would like engage in Musar was, it was very almost like depressing. Because you're asking a question, how did I do today? And the answer, you knew in advance, not that good. Doesn't matter how your day was. The model was, how's your day? Not good. Really? Yeah, definitely not good enough. And it was constant self-appraisal, and it was breaking you in a certain sense. The emotion of fear, the sense of lowliness, self-negation, constant self-appraisal, the consciousness of sin. It was an initial, one way of engaging. Which the Rav described, it was like early Baalei HaMusar, it was just like very much going to like you a little bit. It's going to break you a little bit. Like, yeah, you're always thinking about how you sinned. Anything good that you did, you're thinking about how it could have been better. Anything bad that you did, you're thinking about how bad you are. And the constant emphasis was something which was really, complicated. Says the Rav, though, as he points out, that there was a bit of a shift. He points out even, like, in Kavna and Ben Sabarka, the minhag, as Shabbos was ending, was to be in an atmosphere suffused with sadness and grief. Like, you would sit at the end of Shabbos, and it was, like, the most depressing place to be. Not because it was, like, going too late or the food wasn't that good, you know? That one, you know? But no, this is like, it was breaking you in a certain sense. The Rav describes that there was a shift, though, in the Musar movement. Elements of this, the Altar of Sabatka is definitely responsible for, which is a bit of a shift, which is a Chepan HaNefesh, which is not going to break you, but a Chepan HaNefesh, which is going to empower you. It's going to empower you through a recognition for the Altar of Sabatka, which he emphasized so often, a bunch of years ago, of a godless Ha'adam, of man's indescribable potential, man's indescribable koach, man's indescribable ability to accomplish things. And in a certain sense, if you look at source number five, an old friend of mine, Rabbi Willig's son, Rabbi Simcha Willig, he's a really exciting, charismatic, talented person who has a doctorate from NYU on the educational philosophy of the Altar of Slobodka. So what I put on the sheet is part of his doctorate. By that I mean, it's an earlier draft that I have of it. I don't know if it's exactly like this in the final draft. But one thing which he points out was, reaching a point for Baalei HaMusar of self-awareness, it's very hard to be totally self-aware. It's very hard to be self-aware because how do I know if what I'm viewing about myself is actually accurate? That's always one of the challenges. You make decisions in life based on what you think is, what are your strengths, what do you think is good for you. The problem is that sometimes, I don't know if I read myself as well as possible, that's why outside advice of people that can read you well will be at times very helpful. But to reach a madrega where I can really appreciate myself, that's something which is very hard. Point out that at the Altar of Sabatka, it was a very demanding approach. It was a demanding approach not because you're so bad, but because you are so great and you can be so great. And one of the questions that the Altar would give you as far as the Cheshbon HaNefesh wasn't necessarily a question of, am I balanced in the middle, did I repay the debt? But he would quote the Maimer Chazal often, which is Sayagia Ma'asayel Ma'asayavos, Arav Mitzvah Yaakov. At what point, Chazal tells, the person should ask himself, when are my actions going to reach? The mentor says, the actions, the levels of Avraham Mitzvah Yaakov. Like, when am I going to reach that level? That, by the way, could be asked in a way which is going to break you. Because if the answer always is no, so then, well, I'm so low. For the Altar of Slobodka, it's an empowering question, which a person is supposed to ask themselves. When are you going to be able to reach those madregas that you have the ability to reach? It was there to be mechazik, to play up the greatness. So whereas Baalei HaMusar as a whole are all going to value this self-appraisal, this Chepan HaNefesh, for some it's constant, it's a focus on sin. In the beginning it can sort of break you a little bit. For the Altar of Slobodka, it's powerful, because if you stop and you ponder for a minute, we could actually do it. We could actually do it. We have that potential to do more than we initially think. The mashal, I'm sorry, it's like a sports heavy zone. I don't know why. But yesterday we spoke about it. So I'm going there again today. Is that you have these teams sometimes? My son showed me like an article about this. That like the biggest turnarounds from season to season Like, you know, like, they won, they went 4-12 last year, now they're 12-4. Like, you have these turnarounds take place sometimes. So there's that shift sometimes when the team realizes it's a new season and they're used to losing a little bit. And they realize at some point, like, we may actually be good. And we could actually make the playoffs. And we could actually win the Super Bowl. Like, it's a shift that takes place sometimes, which is a shift for the Altar of Sabatka, which is an important shift. Not a shift of how bad you are, but a shift of, like, you can actually do this. Like, this may actually work. You may actually become this. And for the Altar of Sabatka, that is a very empowering approach as far as the Chasma Nefesh, which can build us, excite us, and be able to inspire us, albeit one that does have a degree of intensity. So that's Bali HaMusar. Rav Kook has a bit of a different discussion. Rav Kook is, in a couple of places in his writings, relates to Chasma Nefesh. By that I mean, I'm aware of a couple. I imagine that there are many more. One is in Oris HaKodesh, the other is in Musar Avicha. We learned Musar Avicha 2 years ago on Wednesday morning. We spoke about some of this then, but let's appreciate things a little bit. Rav Kook is aware of two things. He's very much aware of a cheshbon hanefesh, which can break a person, which can make you feel bad about yourself. How you doing? Not so great. He's aware of that. That's why Rav Kook had this, I think they attribute it to Rav Kook, this ashamnu bagadnu, this vidoy of Aleph Beis. You see it sometimes in some places. I don't know. I never saw it until I was in Israel. But like once in a while, you see this around, like on people's fridges. I think I saw this once or twice. Like I think that they post. Like it's a vidoy based on Aleph Beis of like the mitzvahs that you've done, instead of just emphasizing sometimes the aviras, but emphasizing also like what are the good things that I've done. You know, so it's like I don't know, whatever it would be. You're referencing different things as far as the positives of it, which is a different orientation also. Rav Kook's aware of the fact that cheshbon nefesh can sometimes lower a person. So one's inserting a degree of positivity. Rav Kook in Oros HaKodesh speaks about, as many of us may, I don't know if people do this because it has to do with what you do before you go to sleep at night. It's one of those things we spoke about in the past. Like, there are things where it's easy to know what the Minhag HaOlam is and things that's very hard to know what the Minhag HaOlam is by looking around. Like, what do people do in the morning as far as like when they go to night, like when they watch the Tehillat HaDayim, when they go to the bathroom, when they put on tzitzit, when they whatever, and you're like, the Minhag HaOlam is, it's like, I don't have a clue what the Minhag HaOlam is because I only really know what I do. Like, it's hard to know. You don't see these things sometimes. So what bedtime, pre-bedtime procedure is, I don't have a clue. I don't know how many people say the first or all three paragraphs of creation. I don't know people say Hamapil or don't say how many people say Hamapil at night before they go to sleep at night? How many don't say it? Okay, that makes sense. How many, like, and like, if you, anyone here say like the Vidoy at night before you go to, so if you say the, I'm sure, the, but Rav Kook speaks about the Vidoy before you go to bed. It's like admitting certain sins. He has a line there that I think is really important. It's the one thing that does. You say that at the end of the day, and like you're thinking about how your actions were and how you did. So he says, you know, you're misvadim heimlif nesin shinas makvu alatim v'alam kulo. We're regretting certain things that we did. Also, lifachot, that experience of engaging in cheshbon hanefesh, that experience, says Rav Kook, lifachot megalim heim et machautam aharisha hapratit v'akalit b'chol makom shehi. At minimum, one thing you're doing is at least it's like a token protest. Like, I'm not okay. No, I'm not okay with this. It doesn't have to be that radically transforms you every day. It doesn't have to be, but it's something I can say, and you know, Hashem, this has happened today, and like, just know, like, I'm not so okay with this. Like, a little bit of a protest to it. Like, I know I did it, and like, one act of it, it's not only about, like, the impact of change that you get from Chasbana Nefesh, but just thinking about it sometimes is at least a statement that I know there's a problem here, and I would like to get better. That in and of itself is a certain value in cheshbon hanefesh, says Rav Kook, in a certain kind of reflecting upon things, because that's important. It's important. I use my phone too much. I'm probably going to use it, I was going to say tomorrow, but hopefully tomorrow I won't. It's Shabbos. But I'm going to use it probably too much on Sunday also. But at minimum, I can say, I use my phone too much. Not, I believe Rav Kook is conscious of this, not a cheshbon hanefesh, which is about, this is like sometimes you have this in conversations with people. It's a very depressing moment. I think Rav Kook critiques this also in one context. It's like cheshbon hanefesh as a way of justifying where you are. It's like, listen, I've thought about myself. I understand myself. This is just who I am. Not a cheshbon hanefesh, which is about inspiring you, or a cheshbon hanefesh, which is noting like a reassessment of things. I remember it's like, listen, it's just like, it's just who I am. It's just who I am. You know, I'm just a guy that like, I can't do anything in the morning before 11:45. And I'm like, that's like who you are? Yeah, it's just like, it's who I am. It's who I am. Rabbi, get used to it. You know, that's just like who I am. It's like in the summer sometimes, like high school, you hear lines like that. This is just, it's who I am. It's who I am. So there's a chepen of nefesh, which can be destructive, Rav Kook says. So one part of it, the bad chepen of nefesh, is one which is used to sort of like justify where you're at a little bit. It is who I am, you know, okay, I'm not the best father in the world. Okay, not, and therefore I want to become a better father, but listen, it is who I am. It's who I am, I'm not that good of a, that's something which is very detrimental. It is the opposite of what the Chovas was talking about last week, of like a character trait of a person that's always growth-oriented, thinking about how they can get better. Rav Kook is also, again, saying, even if it doesn't change into action, it's important to be open and honest with ourselves about, you know, what's not okay. That has a certain toilas also. Rav Kook and Musar Avicha is very hesitant and nervous about something else, which is a common mistake. Chesed and Nefesh sometimes, and this is a theme, I think, in a lot of his writings, with Yerushalayim also, there are like elements of worship of God that I just like really, they make me feel sad, or they make me feel scared, and I just don't know if I want that. Like, real, like, fear of punishment is just like, I don't want that. Like, there are mice by the Hasidim of like Reb Zusha. They're Reb Zusha, Davin, Tashem. Like, I know I have to have like half of Ahava and half of Yirik. I just please have like only Ahava. Like, we would all love, in a certain sense, like, let everything be positive, let everything feel good, let everything smile, let everything be whatever it is. But the challenge is, in a certain sense, that like, that's not real. That's not real. And there are certain elements of Roshan which have within us connotations that make us feel uncomfortable. So like, Yerushalayim, I'm talking about like, you know, people don't do this as much nowadays, like getting up and like giving like a, yeah, it's only in certain places, and like it's all about like the fear of Gehenna. The fear of Gehenna. You can speak strongly. We don't live in a world that emphasizes so much Gehenna. That's not where we like go. I don't think, you know, wasn't that last night's like Sichas Musar? I don't think that's typically where they go. It's more like it's really good to do chesed, you know, like things like that. It's really like, it's important to daven with kavana. All the power to you. You know, learning is really great. Check. You know, like those kinds of things, which are important and valuable. It's not like, Chevy, just realize, like, no one is ever having the line, if you don't learn consistently next week, you are sone asamakam, sone sabrios. No one says that stuff nowadays anymore. That era, that ship has sailed as far as formulations. Who would ever do such a thing? So that being the case, so Yerushalayim, says Rav Kook, sometimes these ideas, they come along with this like, I don't think I want this Yerushalayim thing so much, it's just too intense. So one thing that Rav Kook points out is that a Yerushalayim and a Chesed and a Nefesh, we have to shift the connotation that it has, we have to view it a little bit differently, put it in its proper context, not I am who I am, that for sure not, but have it be part of something which empowers you and makes you better. Real Yerushalayim does not break a person. That some of the greatest Yerushalayim smile a lot, and they're really able to be pleasant human beings because they feel like the Yerushalayim is a Yerushalayim which is empowering, allowing them to progress, and as they get empowered and can progress and can become better, so they become better. They become better. And if it's a Yerushalayim, and sometimes, says Rav Kook, the Chesed and Nefesh, which just brings you down and doesn't make you better, we think Chesed and Nefesh is supposed to make us sad. We think that's part of it. That's not part of it. That sometimes is a byproduct of it. That's not what it's about. It's about how do you have a conversation to become better. We're sticking with sports because the muscles work here in a certain sense. You know, it's like that, and we've all seen movies with this, like that huddle where the coach like gets everyone going at some point in time, or that halftime huddle where like everyone's in and it's like, you know, those words of inspiration, you know, whatever it is. You know, we can all think of examples right now. So that, what you have there at the moment, does anyone think that, like, the halftime show, you know, the halftime conversation when the coach comes in and he's like, listen, we really weren't doing well in area A and B is a depressing conversation? The goal there isn't to break you. That's an empowering one. It's an empowering one, especially all the ones that you see in movies because they always win in the second half. spoiler alert. So what you're doing is you're giving it a certain kind of experience, a certain kind of pump up, which is about allowing you. It's about making yourself better. It's about making yourself better. It's like mashal lemahadavar doma. When if a couple is having a bit of a difficult time, and they go to therapy together, and it's a good therapist, and it's a case where they there's a lot of potential in the relationship, and they can do a great job. So the therapy, even though elements of it are sometimes maybe a little bit difficult, because you're embracing realities that maybe aren't ideal. But if you're in a situation like that, it's an immensely powerful, inspiring, growth-oriented experience. Because you're talking about building for going forward. That, says Rav Kook, is part of what we're going for. That's part of what we want. There are times where it creates a feeling that I don't want to engage in it. If it creates a feeling, which is number one, it's a protest that these things that I'm doing aren't so great. And it's one which is not about me understanding myself so I can say, this is just who I am. That's never, it's not called a nefesh. That's called a way of justifying a form of mediocrity. What we're talking about is understanding yourself so you can become even better. Saying yourself so it can empower you. Not one which is overwhelmed in a certain sense, but one that can actually move you a little bit. So that's Bali Musar, that's of Cook. I want to actually focus on a really interesting article in number 8. It's a Rav who I think is fairly well known, especially in certain communities in America, Rav Moshe Hauer. Moshe Hauer is a Rav of a shul in Baltimore. A very insightful person. He wrote in a journal called Klal Perspectives. It was around for a couple of years. It was a journal with different rabbanim. It was actually really amazing. You had to get like a pretty broad spectrum of society, people from different communities, people from different orientations, all writing together in a very nice way. And a lot of they had a journal. One of the journals dedicated to being a Baal HaBayis. It's like before, if you're familiar with Lopiansky's book, before it came out. It's very hard to be a person that works, has a family, that's supposed to learn, wants to be involved in community. There's so many things. And even being part of a family, there's so many relationships as being part of a family. In a family, for me, right now, I'm blessed to be a husband and a father, a son and a grandson, a brother. There are a lot of family relationships that we're pulled. And work is very difficult. And you may have two jobs, and you may have, as part of your job, different obligations. And to be firm, I want to daven every day. I want to learn every day. I want to learn Daf Yomi. I'm inspired by Sima Shama. So, and it's very, very hard. And the journal was dedicated towards giving insight and perspective to those who are working. Because this is the challenge sometimes. People who are very much growth-oriented, people that want to be successful, who are used to learning and davening and doing well in school, etc., they sometimes wake up and they realize, like, whoa, there's just too much on my plate, and I'm not able to accomplish everything that I want to be able to accomplish. And that can become a little bit frustrating sometimes. I want to learn every day, but like, also support my family. For my family requires a lot of time. Then I want to come home and like say hello to my children. And then I want to. So many days. It's hard. And how a power person manages that. So there are a lot of challenges facing the contemporary Baal HaBayis. All those problems will not be solved if you just never work. You'll just have other problems that you'll then be navigating. So it's something we want to do, but there's a lot to talk about. As a Rav of a shul articulates a couple of things. I'm sorry you don't have this section of it, and I guess I only read the parts that we don't have. Life is challenging for everyone. So much to do, so little time. This is arguably even more of an issue in the complex world of the contemporary Baal HaBayis, with a larger family and numerous religious obligations and goals. There's like so much to do. There's so much to do. The struggle to meet the challenge can produce overwhelming guilt, stress, and exhaustion. Just really, really tired. Just really, really tired. You know, it's an inspiring thing what people can pull up, like how much is on their plate. If you saw, Rabbi Ari Boy Andrew was here last Shabbos and this week, and he played with Shlomo Katz, an amazingly talented Rebbe, an amazingly talented guitarist. So he works in Rambam. He's a teacher in Rambam. He's there full-time. He's there for a lot of hours. He also is playing like 3 or 4 weddings a week. He's playing at night. So Waxman was saying to me like last night, like he's like reflecting upon it. Like he's like I'm just so inspired by him. Like he seems to like have things together. Like when you have a wedding at night, like what time are you going to sleep that night? Is it Brooklyn? I think. Where are the weddings? What time are you going to sleep at night? Before 2? Like, no, he wakes up the next morning, he has, like, a full time, and he has kids. Bachman's like, he also seems to be, like, a great father, you know, you have, like, he's like, I don't know, this is, like, this is impressive stuff, you know? Like, it's exhaust. It's very exhausting. And then you have so many things to do. It's something which is very, very challenging. The people that do that, everyone has their own struggles, even if it looks like externally, like they're holding everything together. Everyone has their own stuff. But it's very hard. It's very, very hard sometimes. And there's a lot to do. A lot to do if you're doing it well. And it feels like even more to do if you're not doing it well. So there are three primary values that can assist each of us in addressing the challenge. Clarity, satisfaction, and support. For Howard, one of the things that can be helpful when you feel a bit overwhelmed at times, when you feel like there's a lot on your plate, cheshbon hanefesh. Guilt and stress, I think this is so helpful. It's asking a bit of a different question than the Shvil Hazav or that I've paid back my Karas HaTov. All the Mahalchim are all true. Be interested in an additional question. Guilt is the result of a sense of failure and meeting expectations. Why does a person feel guilty? I feel guilty because I should have done X and I didn't do X. I was supposed to have washed something at home. I didn't wash. Okay, so now it's my truth advice from last night. So now I feel guilty I didn't do it. Why do I feel guilty? Because I should have done it. If I shouldn't have done something, I don't feel bad about not having done something. I don't know if I shouldn't have run a marathon this morning. I don't wake up and say, Nebuch, I didn't run a marathon this morning. It's okay. Guilt stems from a certain lack of meeting expectations. However, such feelings are eliminated when expectations are appropriately modified according to individual qualities and circumstances. Part of the goal of Cheshbon HaNefesh is forget how you're doing. Just understand what should you realistically be doing. What should you be doing? If you go through the schedule of your day, I want to hear someone say this. Right? He said, I'm going through all the things I feel like I'm supposed to be doing. How much time it takes me. And I realize if my day has 29 hours, I'll be fine. Shocker. It doesn't have 29 hours in a day. So what do you do? So that's part of where the Chabad comes in. Like, if what is the realistic expectation that you could meet? Not as a way of justifying mediocrity, as a way of avoiding the guilt of, how did I not do more and more and more? The answer is, understand that level of Cheshbon HaNefesh, which is, what could I do? If I understand, for example, that in my current circumstance, where I am working on building my career and my family, I may not be expected to, quote, be holding and learning, just like a kollel, a guy learning at kollel, or to function as a communal leader. So now I can focus on what I must be doing instead of being overwhelmed by what I can't be doing. What is realistic for me to do right now? What's not justifying mediocrity, I want to push myself, but like the first step is, what should you be doing? So if you look at your day, a guy in yeshiva sometimes, you know, like, talk to a guy and he's like, he's so overwhelmed and like so like a lot. I'm like, so what would your ideal day look like? Look at the schedule. I'm like, that's your weekly schedule or daily schedule? You're like, that's the expectation of what you want to do in a week or in a day. And it's like, look at it and you're like, that's going to create intense feelings of guilt because we're just what we could potentially do and how things could be in as good a spot as possible. If any of you, as your shtick, if you ask someone to open the door every time, it's fantastic. Fantastic. Similarly, stress sometimes is the result of being pulled in different directions. Do this, have to do that, do that. And the person can feel very overwhelmed and stressed. I can speak about that with authority. Thus, it's easier when you have hours of block time dedicated to working on a single project. But in the nature of a life where you're very, very busy and doing a million things can build a lot of stress. The perceived need, quote, to do it all at all times is a huge stress builder. Part of what Chabad can do is be able to help a person reflect upon how they should allocate their time, what's called proper boundaries, what's called standards, what could I actually meet. And to be able to do so is something which is very, very valuable, which can be immensely, immensely valuable. To be able to reflect on where it is that you happen, where it is that you happen to be. It's a different question. In the world in which I live, what is the most, what's realistic for me? Not because I'm not justifying, oh yeah, I guess for me, it's unrealistic to like put on film this morning and I'm good. It's not what it is. It's holding yourself to standards. This is talking to a person that's the problem. Rav Kook was talking on some level to a guy that's saying, I'm looking at Chabad Nefesh to justify lower standards. For him, it's about let's push, let's empower. But Howard's talking to a person that has very high standards to the extent to which they're being overwhelmed. And for him, it's like, no. Be realistic. In your day, in your 24 hours, what can and what should you be doing? not too little and not too much. How do I allocate my time so I don't feel stressed and overwhelmed by different things? And engaging with the nefesh for him is an amazingly effective tool to deal with feelings of guilt and stress that I'm not accomplishing much as I should. I've had these conversations. Some of you may have thought of elements. I've had conversations sometimes where a guy says, like, I don't know, I'm in yeshiva, and I feel enormous pressure. Like, if I don't do X by the end of the year, like, it means I didn't maximize my time that well. It means that I didn't do well in yeshiva if I didn't get to X. And a lot of the times when in those conversations, X is usually some, like, unfathomably realistic, unrealistic, like, aspiration. Like, if I don't know, like, if I can't do the pin test on Baba Kama, you know, where you, like, you stick the pin through the Gemara, you say what word did it go through on every single Amud, then, like, why was I even here? So I'll respond with, like, I know, you're right. I don't know, they, like, what do you want from, you know, like, obvious, ridiculous. Or the guy, like, well, if I can't do X and Y, then, like, I'm not going to be there. I'm like, so it actually, oddly enough, doesn't work that way, you know? Like, the year in Israel is really important. 2 years is also, it's a wonderful thing. But it's not going to be like you've completed everything right now. And then the time that you're allocating, which is wonderful, holy, and good, that suddenly your Bekiyas and Yerushalmi Kilayim is going to be exactly where it needs to be. A transformative effect when you do get to open it, for sure. But then you're going to say, I'm not holding the basics of Hilchos Shabbos. I don't know the basics of Hilchos Tefillah, Hilchos Brachos. I'm not holding an old Baba Kama right now. I don't remember everything I learned when I was in high school. I'm stuck in that I haven't yet. I was told it. Someone told me that. So Sharm's an important safer as Chobos Levavos. I haven't yet been Messiah in them. And I'm just like, I don't know what to do. Like, I'm a failure. And I'm saying it now in extreme terms. It's very, very, very rare that someone says it in those extreme terms. But we say it sometimes in ways that are also not. I say it's not to lower expectations because I think it's how I say it because if you want the Chachman HaNefesh to inspire you and to move you, you want to have an avoda, which Rav Kook is emphasizes, the Altar of Sabaka emphasizes, Rabbi Hauer emphasizes here, of an avoda which is not overly stressful and filled with feelings of guilt, but also an avoda Hashem, which is avoda, it's demanding, it is challenging, and I'm pushing. So you have to strike a certain kind of balance as far as how we engage in avoda Hashem. What are the questions we ask? Chobos HaLevavos, Rambam, Ramchal. There are different questions. Obviously, they all agree with each other in a certain perspective. But part of the underlying goal I would just want to end with is the following. Chesed HaNefesh, whether it's a prerequisite for all growth, whether it's what we're striving to be a person that's always thinking, and how can I be better, certainly there. A Jew has to engage in Chesed HaNefesh, but we want to avoid two extremes and strike a very, very healthy middle. We want to avoid one perspective which says, I understand who I am and this is all I'll ever be. This is all I am right now. I don't remember things, so I'll never remember anything in Torah. I don't concentrate well, so I'll never be able to daven, and that's it. It's a very dangerous form of Chesed HaNefesh. We don't want to engage with an effort which is taking Slabarka to an extreme, and say, well, how am I going to come out of Avinu by Shabbos? You know, I don't have time to be. How am I going to come out of it? I'm like, I'm trying so hard, and like, Hashem has not yet revealed himself to me. I have not yet had a Lech Lecha moment. It's like you're like preparing for the Akedah. I don't even know what you're like. You know, like these like experience. No, it's not either that. Also, it's not too much. It's a Chesed HaNefesh, which is there to move us forward in the ways that make the most sense for us to move forward. To move us forward, to be demanding, but to do so in a way which is not to be overridden with guilt and stress, but not doing more and pulled. But I have to learn Musar, I have to learn Mush, I have to learn that. Allocate time. It's something that's about allocating time well, so you can know I'm spending the right amount of time learning Halacha. Good. Right time learning Gemara, and that's good. And it can inspire me and move me to build in a way which empowers me. And to engage in Nefesh is something which can be very, very valuable. In the world in which we live, where there are phones on us all the time, we're very, very busy. So I think they tell Maisa over, I don't know if it's true, although I like it a lot, that Rav Huttner once saw a guy going on a bus, or a Sheirut, we'll give our example. And the guy had a safer in hand. And I think, I don't know if it's true, I saw it when I was in high school, I think, or years ago. That Rav Huttner gave the guy a bit of Musar. He said, I understand, if you're always learning, when are you ever going to think? Like, when's that ever going to happen if we're always doing it? Okay, so nowadays, we wouldn't talk about the safer on the thing, and we would talk about phone use, myself included, but like, if you're always, always, always going to be engaged and consuming and taking in, so when is that time to think? And to think means, what can I be doing? How am I doing? And how can it move me forward in a way which is realistic? It is a chapa nefesh which is causing you to have guilt and stress, and it's impinging on your ability to be successful. You're just not doing it right. And it's a chapa nefesh which is empowering you, and it makes me feel good also, and it allows me to do better. It's more optimistic, and it's more realistic, and it doesn't engender guilt, so now we know we're doing it right. So we know if we're doing it right or not doing it right, but it's very, very kedai to engage in it. You won't regret it. You won't regret it if you're able to. Have a wonderful Shabbos. I very much...